Reception, and the privilege to introduce him, not from a point of introduction of knowing this is Brother Paul Malley. We all know Brother Paul Malley, but we all enjoy his discourses and the fellowship with Brother Paul Malley. So Brother Paul Malley, has chosen a subject which will be very beneficial to us, and I'm sure that with pencils and pens in hand and notepads, we're going to have ample notes at the end of his discourse, and we're going to allot Brother Paul the full time allocated to his discourse. So the subject is the smiting of the Jordan. So Brother, we'll turn the program over to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm looking for Mary, because when she does this, I'm talking too loud. I see her now. And when she does this, speak up. We do have a fan situation, so we'll try to find the balance between too loud and too soft. I bring you the love and greetings from your brethren in the New London Groton area, some of which are here, so they'll do the job for themselves. But there are those who remain behind, and so I convey to you that love and greetings. And also I bring you the love and greetings from Israel. We just arrived about a week ago from Jack and Connie Campbell, as well as Stuart Livermore. Some of you remember him. And they want to be remembered to convention. They think of you, and they think of us a great deal. We spent the day with them, so it was a great, enriching experience for us. And I might say parenthetically that the Jerusalem Convention in 1993 is going on schedule, and we have collected many signs that the Lord is going to bless this effort. And so, if you haven't already noticed the publicity, and if you're just casually interested, may I suggest that you get at least the newsletters that are being printed, otherwise you won't know what's going on. And the way you would do that is to see the secretary of the convention, and that is Dawn Shalhoub. And she is here today to take your names and addresses if you have a casual interest. That doesn't mean you are registering for it, but you'd like to know what's going on and to see at some future point in time if the Lord will permit you to attend. If God has given us a clock, we should know what time it is. I don't think anybody will disagree. God has given us a clock. What time is it? If God has said, as God has given us a plan, we ought to know what's happening. Where are we going? Where have we been? If God has said an old world must go, why is it still here? Do we see changes in the world, or are we blind? If God has given us a harvest to reap His people, why are we still here? When will I make my calling and election sure? If God has regathered Israel, why hasn't the Gog of the North invaded it? If God has given us the seventh messenger, we want to know, why is it that there is more time from 1914 to 1991 than it was from 1874 to 1914? It was 40 years from 1874 to 1914, but it's 77 years from 1914 to 1991. We got questions. We got inquiries. We're students. Shouldn't students inquire
Isn't that their function? Isn't that their nature?
I was looking to Mary to see if I was going to get that, but no. The journey of Elijah and Elisha in 2 Kings, the second chapter, gives us feet members of the church in the flesh some insight as to what's happening and what will happen. And our lesson this morning will be about these prophets. Now, since the events associated with these prophets are prophetic, our remarks are going to be in the form of suggestions. Likelihoods. Please do not construe my remarks as dogmatic. Now, there are two general approaches in explaining the antitype. One is the historic approach. That is, the four stopping points, which we will get into in a minute, represent four conditions of the church during the harvest period from 1874 to the present time. This has been the historic approach, and we think this is a good interpretation. I kind of favor it myself. And we can associate dates with that and accept it. I'm going to take a little different approach this morning. I'm going to take a personal approach. Elijah and Elisha does represent the conditions of the harvest church, but it also represents our conditions. So we're going to try to make it more of a personal kind of thing, and therefore make it more vital and make it more in the form of lessons to learn. Now, Elijah and Elisha typify two classes of the Spirit begotten in the closing stages of the gospel age. Elijah, a type of the overcomer in the flesh. Elisha, a type of the less faithful in the flesh. Elijah, a type of the church. Elisha, a type of the great company class. Now, this thought is supported in Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, where it says, "Behold, I will send Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord." And also in Matthew 17, 10 to 13, our Lord himself says something powerful, friends. He says, Elijah truly shall come, but Elijah's already here. Well, that's a lot of double talk. How could he come when he's already here? If you listen carefully, he was saying, there are two Elijahs that he's predicting. One that is already here and one that is yet to come. Incidentally, double predictions in the scriptures is found most any places. Just to give an example, Daniel. Remember Daniel in the vision of the animals? Remember the four beasts? The first one was a lion. The second one was a leopard. The third one was a bear. We know those animals. We see them in the zoo all the time. But the fourth one, wasn't that strange? This was an animal. He couldn't describe it. He says, it's a terrible. You can't describe it. How come God gave three animals that we all recognize, and the fourth he didn't? He could have used an elephant. That's a pretty big animal. He could have used that. Why did he say this animal? You can't tell. It's hideous. It's indescribable. Well, as Bible students, we know that what he was saying, something important to that animal, he says there's a double prediction to that animal. That animal predicted the Roman Empire from 150 B.C. to 500 A.D., but it also had a translation to the end times. Look to that animal, and you'll know about something at the end of the age. And so it is with Jesus. He said the same thing. Elijah's here, but he's yet to come. He was saying that there's really two that he was referring to, and if we add the third, there are three Elijahs. The first, the original,
which the Lord uses as lessons for us. The second, he was referring to John the Baptist because the disciple says, oh, he was talking about John the Baptist. And the third, we would suggest to you, represents the church in the flesh at the end of the age. Friends, you know who that is? That's not somebody in Europe. That's not somebody in South America. You know who that is? That's you. That's me. We're talking about us. And thus, we are now beginning to bring out personal lessons in this wonderful picture. We're reading about us. And if you never had the experience of studying Elijah and Elisha, if this is the first exposition of it, you really are missing much because the Lord is communicating to us. Never let it be said that God hasn't told us what time it is, where are we going, where we've been. Never let it be said because the Lord gives us clues. We see then three Elijahs. The first, lesson for us. Second, John the Baptist. The third, the church in the flesh. Study the lives of these two, and you will learn something about your future. Study the events of the types, and you will learn something about end times. Study how they came to an end, and you will learn how your life will come to an end. That is, those of you who regard yourself as Elijah type. If you don't, then nothing is relevant at this point. Study their lives, and you'll see how God is leading us. And he tells us what will happen. Now, we know some important features and some correspondences between the three Elijahs. They all preached righteousness, and they called for repentance. All three found only a few people loyal to God. All three were persecuted by Jezebel. All three. Jezebel was after all three. The first by the original Jezebel, the second by the antitypical Jezebel, who was Herodias, who succeeded in killing John. The third, in our time, presently, antitypical Jezebel, who seeks to destroy the church in the flesh. We believe the contemporary Jezebel is the papal system. All three Jezebels received persecuting power from the government. The first from Ahab the king, and incidentally, kings in those days were the government. Kings in those days were government. Okay? The second was from Herod the king. Herod, the government, gave power to Jezebel, antitypical Herodias, and later on we'll know it as organized religion. And the third Jezebel will receive, the third Jezebel, the papal system, will receive power from a consortium of governments, or we can even suggest the United Nations. Everybody's looking for the United Nations now. Power has now vested. We never thought of the United Nations as having power. Look at the power they had in the Gulf War in making decisions. Look at how everybody's looking to the United Nations. Syria has now said, we want the United Nations to be in the peace process. Kurdistan, or the unwritten Kurdistans of the Kurds. We want the United States, but if we don't get the United States, we want the United Nations. The United Nations is now infused with power like they've never had before. All three Elijahs had successors. If you had three Elijahs, you got three successors. The first, it was the original Elijah, who was Elisha. Elisha carried on the work of Elijah. The second successor of John the Baptist, we had his disciples. The third, the successor of the church in the flesh, is none other than the great company class, Elisha. The first Elijah's ministry ended by a devastating whirlwind of turmoil. So also the second Elijah, John the Baptist's ministry, ended by a decapitation of his life.
And so also the third Elijah, the church in the flesh. Their ministry will end with a devastating whirlwind of turmoil and disaster. The failure of the first two Elijahs, they failed, will be replaced by the partial success of the third. I say partial because the third will not succeed as well, and that's the reason why the Lord says, Armageddon, let's clean it all up. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. Remember, Malachi 4:6, Elijah will turn the fathers to the children, and the children to the fathers. We're going to suggest to you the fathers here represent Israel and the prophets, and the children represent the world. So Elijah is going to turn the world to Israel and Israel to the world, and I can't help but say that the world's focus on Israel is unparalleled in history. The focus on Israel is unprecedented. Everybody looks at Israel. Now, we all know the journey of Elijah and Elisha. They stopped at Gilgal, then at Bethel, then they met the sons of the prophets, then they stopped at Jericho, and they met the sons of the prophets. They start at Jordan, they met the sons of the prophets again. Elijah takes his mantle, wraps it together, smites the Jordan, the waters divide, and they both pass over to the other side. Then a chariot of fire with wild horses. If you picture the vision, and this was actual in terms of the original. A chariot of horses came down from heaven. And if you can envision a chariot flaming with flaming horses comes down, and it goes right through them, separates them, picks up Elijah into the chariot, and the whirlwind comes and takes Elijah to heaven. Elisha sees all this, picks up the mantle, goes back to the Jordan, strikes it the second time. There's two smitings. And then Elisha carries on the work of Elijah. Now let's examine some of the issues involved in this type. First issue. I think it's a big issue. In fact, I would say it may even be the most important issue. Who is Elijah and who is Elisha? So you say, well, one is the church class and one is the great company class. But which class are you in? Can we tell by looking at each other who is who? We look at each other all the time. We shake hands and we fellowship. Can I say, oh, you're an Elijah? And can I say, you're an Elisha? Can we do it by looking at each other? Of course not. And don't try it. We can't by looking at each other. We do not have the ability to read the heart. We do not have the ability to see within each other. Many brethren think the separation does not occur until the whirlwind. That's a departing separation. But in the eyes of God, they're already separated. Two classes, Elijah and Elisha. There's already two classes walking the narrow way. But does God give us some way that we can personally determine which class we're in? And I would say yes. God gives us four measures from the journey. Let's take the first one. Elisha's like a spiritual father to Elisha. Remember when Elijah left Sinai, he met Elisha. He was a farmer. He was plowing the field. Elijah threw his mantle over Elisha, and he once Elisha stopped plowing. And a relationship developed between the two. Elisha began to prophesy. Elijah was like a father to Elisha. Elijah was his teacher. Elijah gave him the truth. And so we would suggest to you that the church class is like a father to the great company class.
The church class is a teacher unto the great company class. The church class executes rightly dividing the word of truth. Elisha loved and respected and clung to Elijah even after the departing separation. Remember what Elisha called Elijah? He said, "My father, my father." And so the church class is a father in their private relationships. They are, and until they are undergo their departing separation. But the important thing is they walk the narrow way together. There's a second measure. It's the stops of the journey. Gilgal was the site where all the males from the wilderness journey, when they crossed over the Jordan from the wilderness experience, there were many males that were uncircumcised. It's 3 miles from the Jordan. The site is still there. All the males were circumcised at that point. Gilgal means rolling away, but if you look at the Hebrew carefully, it means rolling away the flesh. Rolling away the flesh, Joshua 5:9. Note, Elijah talks to Elisha, and he says, "Would you like to stay here?" And Elisha says, "No." Why did he say that? Because Elijah saw the fleshly tendencies that Elisha had. He says, "Stay here and take care of your fleshly tendencies." But Elisha says, "No, no, I want to go with you." And so at Bethel, Bethel was the site in which Abraham and Lot separated, Genesis 13:3-11. And now if you're at that site in Bethel and you look south, you will see the Dead Sea. And if it's true that Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah, was at the southern tip of the Dead Sea, according to the Bible as history, they claim that there are ruins there, you could see the sea. Lot saw the sea, the cities, the sea and the cities. Lot saw them. Lot saw, "Oh, there's some cities over here. Oh, we can have a good time. We can work, you know, 6 days a week like farmers do. But on a day off, we can go to the city. We can go shopping. Have a little entertainment." And so Lot saw the worldly pleasures. "Hey, I'm going to pick that site." And so Bethel then, we would suggest to you, represents the worldly interests in these cities. And again, Elijah says to Elisha, "You want to stay here?" He said, "Would you like to pursue your worldly interests?" And Elisha says, "No, I want to come with you." Then comes Jericho, the site of the precipitous and dangerous Quarantana, which is historically the place where Jesus was tempted by Satan. And Jericho is right near the Jordan River, and so we would say this represents the descending into temptation, and again, this becomes a temptation condition. And again, Elijah says to Elisha, "Stay here. Relax. Give in to your temptation." And what does Elisha say? "No. I want to come with you." And that's in the clue about the great company class. They are a class that have these tendencies, and sometimes they do favor them, but they don't stay. They keep on with the truth. They keep with the Elijah class. They follow the Elijah class. They cling to the Elijah class. They have those tendencies, but they stay, which is a beautiful evaluation of the great company class. God loves the great company class, and God understands the weaknesses that they have. They have many weaknesses. And we're talking about us, friends. We're not talking about somebody around the world, halfway around. We're talking about us. We know the great company class is among us. They have weaknesses, and sometimes they can't overcome them. And Elijah, so lovingly, "Would you want to stay here?" "No, I want to come with you." "Then come. Come with me." That's a lesson. We'll come back to it in a minute, time allows. Then comes the Jordan. This is the site where Israel crossed from the wilderness to the promised land, which means from death to life, to cross back. Get that point? Israel, when they crossed, went from death to life. When they cross back, they go from life to death. Elijah knew he was going to his death in smiting the Jordan. To cross that Jordan will mean it'll cost him his life. He knew it. And thus we see the stops of the journey differentiated the two. Elijah did not have these problems about hesitancy. In each stop, he expected to be translated, just like in a harvest period. The church was expected to be translated at different conditions. But it didn't happen. One of the reasons why he expected it is because he knew Jezebel was after him. Jezebel wanted to kill him. Let's take a third measure. The third measure of differentiating Elijah was the first smiting of the Jordan. This was the work of Elijah. I'll have more to say that in a minute, but suffice it to say that the work of smiting the Jordan was Elijah. Elisha merely goes along. Elisha just looks. That's another lesson, friend. Are you a looker or are you a smiter? You know, it's interesting, we're on the West Coast and we delivered these remarks. And there was a young boy, I think he was 12 years old, and there was a baptism, and while we were going down to the baptism, he was talking to his father, because his father told me the conversation afterwards. And he said to his father, he says, Dad, he says, I want to consecrate myself one day. And the father says, oh, that's good. But why do you say that? He says, because I don't want to be a looker, I want to be a smiter. 12 years old. The desire is there, friends, isn't it? The desire is there. If you answer the question for yourself, I'm a looker. If you're a looker, then you're of the Elisha class. If you're a smiter, then you're of the Elijah class. Only you can answer that. I can't answer it, but the Lord tells us what differentiates the two by the work that they do. Let's take a fourth measure in differentiating the two is the chariot with horses of fire. Horses have always symbolically represented doctrines. Zechariah 12:4, Revelation 6:2-8. Note the horse-drawn chariot goes right through Elijah and Elisha. If they're walking side by side, the chariot goes right through, right between them, and separates them, if you can picture that in your mind. What we're suggesting then is doctrines differentiate in a great measure the two classes. And it's so true that doctrines divide and separate. 2 Corinthians 6:17. Doctrines nourish and give sustenance. 1 Timothy 4:6. Doctrines defend the truth. Titus 1:9. Doctrines isolate. 2 John 9:10. God is telling us something about the horses. It's the doctrines. And when I hear brethren say, doctrines are not important. When I hear that, it's like saying to God, you should have taken the horses out of the picture. And you know, he did in the first chapter of Ezekiel. There were no horses in the chariot. There were no horses there. Why is it there's horses in this vision and not horses over there? Did God make a mistake? I don't think so. We make mistakes, but God doesn't make a mistake. He put horses in there. In the other picture, there were no horses, and he's telling us something. Doctrines are critical. Also, the chariot symbolizes organization. Horses pulling a chariot suggests doctrines well organized. The plan of the ages is well organized. It has a purpose, it has a government, it has a management, it has people, it has resources, it has a timetable. It's well organized. And there you are, four measures to determine which class you're in. And only you can do it. Let's take a second issue of smiting the Jordan. What is the work of smiting the Jordan? Elijah and John the Baptist, the first and second Elijahs, did many things. Should we do everything that they did? Well, I'd say generally, yes. Generally. They spoke out against immorality. We should do the same thing. They spoke out against the idols in Israel. We should do the same thing. They spoke out against government. We should do the same thing. They spoke out against church and state union. We should do the same thing. They revealed the blasphemy in the sanctuary. We should do the same thing. The list is long what they did, but this work was also done by Jeremiah, was done by Zechariah, was done by Isaiah. The work of smiting the Jordan is a special work that nobody has done before. From Matthew 17, remember what Jesus said? Elijah shall come, but he has already come. I think Jesus was giving us a clue that in the life of John, in the life of John the Baptist, we would know what the big work of the coming feet members of the church would be. And if we examine the big work of John, the second Elijah, much that he did, the big work, I hope you will agree with me, was to prepare the way of the Lord for the first advent to Israel. That was his big work. And that's a clue to us that in the feet members of the church, the big work of contemporary Elijah, the third Elijah, is preparing the inauguration of the kingdom. That's what Malachi meant when he says, turn the fathers, the world, to Israel, turn the fathers, Israel, to the children, the world. Now, this is a big work, friends. It's a special work. It's the last work of the church. It's the work of end time. It's the work of culminating the gospel of the high calling. It's the work just before the door of the high calling is closed. In Bible symbolism, water represents truth. It also represents the people with truth. Remember that. You can't separate people with truth. Truth is inanimate. It's people with truth, people with errors, people mixed with truth and error, but it's people. Furthermore, the Jordan means judging down, for the river, Jordan River goes down. But if you read the Hebrew carefully, I did this. Take out the authentic Hebrew books. Jordan is really broken down into two words. It's Jor and Dan. The river Jor comes down from Mount Hermon, pure, clean, unpolluted. And it flowed through the tribe of Dan, one of the tribes, and became polluted, contaminated. We think that represents the truth coming down, going through Christendom. See, the problem with Christendom is it isn't that they are all false, that they're all lies, that they have no truth. That's not the problem with Christendom. The crown of Christendom is mixed in. It's a mixture. It's polluted. It's like soup. The French style, by the way. You know, the French style. You know, the American style in soup, you could see carrots floating. You could see the celery floating. You could see the particles. But with the French, when they make soup, they grind it all up. And you can't tell the difference. It's all mixed in. That's the problem with Christendom. They have some truth. But it's mixed in with so much error. People can't separate them. And don't think because you have the truth that you have the ability. Oh, I have the skill. I separated it. Am I not great? You have the truth. It's because the Lord has opened it for you. And that skill doesn't come from you. It comes from the Lord's special blessing and the Lord's special allocation to you. We are suggesting then the river Jor, clean and pure, goes through and becomes polluted and becomes the Jordan. We're suggesting to you that organized religion, Babylonian in nature, will be divided from its people membership. That's what the division means. Organized religion on one side with government supporting it, and on the other side, the people. On the one side of Jordan, we will find
the organized religions, their traditions, their money, their organizations, their creeds, their beliefs. And on the other side, we'll see the people who desire, people who sincerely want to know God and want to worship God. And they're convinced that God is there. Incidentally, a recent statistics and the Gallup poll, 97% of the Americans believe in the God. 97! You'd think they'd be more atheists. They believe in the God, and Gallup poll is within plus or minus 5% error. 97% believe in the God, and only 40% attend church services. Does that say something? I'll let you interpret that. My interpretation is, they believe in God, they want to worship God, they want to be with God. But their organization's got problems, and they sense it, and they know it. Take the Catholic Church. It's only been recently they've begun to realize many of the priests are homosexuals. And every day you see insights coming out, because they always used to keep it quiet. But now it's coming out. The smiting will have an impact on civil powers, church-state union. The government will side with organized religion. You know, in the type. Ahab supported Jezebel. And so the governments are going to side with organized religion against the people. The whole civilized world will be affected by this smiting. And I don't have to convince you about how an incident somewhere out in Kuwait, no one ever heard of that country. An incident in Kuwait, and the whole world was involved. And I don't mean every nation. There's about 159 nations in the world. There are 20, I understand, 29 nations that actively participated in the Gulf War. But all the world was involved in the sense of knowing and supporting and so forth. So we ask, what could possibly divide the world as we have suggested? What could possibly separate individual membership from the religions? What could possibly allow citizens to go against government policies? Now, we suggested to you earlier that there is a very special dispensation of truth that will be given to the feet members of the church that will do it. Now, if you ask what special dispensation of truth could be so powerful enough to be miraculous, the answer? I don't know. I don't know. If you will permit me to speculate, I'll make a suggestion. It's got to be connected with Israel. Remember Malachi 4:6? Elijah turns Israel to the world, and the world to Israel. Also, John 4:22, salvation comes from the Jews. Too often we forget that. Salvation comes from the Jews. We Gentiles are grafted on a tree that's Jewish in nature. The Bible is a book of the Jews. Our Lord Jesus was a Jew. The apostles were Jews. And all of the events, the heroes, and the prophecies, and the events, and the lessons, they were Jewish. And I would even go so far as to say, Christianness is largely Jewish. There are some adjustments, some changes. That's why we call ourselves Israelites. I think a very good and a very appropriate definition. And so, it's got to be connected something with Israel. Now, in times which we're living in, anti-Semitism will emerge strong in the world against Israel. In end times, peace will be forced between Israel and the Palestinians by governments and organized religion. And also in Jeremiah 30, 14 and 15, all the lovers will leave Israel. Israel will be alone. Israel's not alone now. In fact, Defense Secretary Cheney has just come out just last night that there's going to be a buildup of armaments, of the American armaments in Israel. Just issued that last night, suggesting that, according to Cheney, Israel is our ally for many, many years. We have never been stronger together. Israel's not alone. You've got the United States on your side. You've got a lot. But in end times, peace will be forced upon Israel, maybe by the United States. In end times, communists will be blaming Israel for the mess that they are in, and they are in a mess. Gorbachev said, I want $100 billion from the West. And he quickly said, if we don't get it, the world will be unshaken, or will be shaken. Those are exact words. If we don't get the $100 billion, the world will be shaken. What does that mean?
I mean, your interpretation is as good as mine. That's his exact words. We want the $100 billion from the West, or the world will be shaken. Was that a threat? If you were starving, you had no food, and people were dying, what would you do? I'll leave the answer to you.
In end times, the in 1916, were Jews. The communists are looking for a scapegoat to blame for the mess that they're in. In end times, Jerusalem will become a burdensome stone around the neck of the world. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all connected in a life and death struggle as to who will possess Jerusalem. Now, even though all the Israeli lovers will leave her, that's the government and organized religion, the people of the world will not. We will not leave. And I don't mean we personally, but the world. They remember the Holocaust. The world can be very sympathetic. The Holocaust was a great experience for the Jews, and the world won't forget it. They remember the suffering the Jews went through. The people will stay with Israel, and thus the separation. Again, friends, we don't know for sure what that is. We're just suggesting. Don't be too surprised that if Israel, when they're alone, the United States will be on the opposite side of the table. My question to you is, where will you be on this issue? Will you support a regathered Israel? Or will you support the American policy of forcing peace on Israel? Israel is 6,000 miles away. America, that's my home, right here. I'm a citizen of the United States. What is your position on this matter? You're going to have to take a position. If you say, no, I'm not going to take a position, I'm going to just look. If you just look, you will be what? An Elisha type. If you, on the other hand, take a position and even cooperate and work towards supporting Israel, then you'll become an Elijah type, because I believe we will have to take that position one day. If you believe the time has come to favor Israel, what are you doing to support your belief? What substance do you have? Let's take a third issue of the journey, the power of the mantle. I do not believe this power is bending the will of the people, whether they like it or not. I mean, free will is always with God. No one's going to force anybody to do what they don't want to do. But we suggest five components to the power. The first is the power is a special dispensation of truth, which we don't know about. We're suggesting it's got to connect it with Israel. It will be like the truth giving at the end of the Jewish age, but it'll be in the context of the 21st century and not the first century. Most of our truths are oriented to the first century. We're looking for a special dispensation oriented to the 21st century, because this truth will be the inauguration of the kingdom. And this truth will have an impact on world civilization, especially Christendom and organized religion. It's got to be an unusual power. Do you think giving a tract to a Muslim will ever change him? I don't think so. Do you think having a conversation with an Orthodox Jew, which I have many times, do you think having a conversation with an Orthodox Jew will convince him? I doubt it. Do you think you move an evangelistic Christian by a videotape? I don't think so. How do you get people to raise questions about their own religion? How do you get people to challenge their own organization? That's the question that we're asking. Do you think it's with rhetoric, with poetry, with conversation? I don't think so. It will be by this special dispensation, because there's a certain power with this. Let's get to that in a minute. The second component of power is the organization. The brethren will be organized worldwide for this special project. We are now in this state. We've always known that there are brethren throughout the world. We now know them by names and addresses and telephones, and some of us are talking to these people. We know the French brethren, the Russian brethren, the Polish brethren, the Swiss brethren, the Japanese, the South. We know these brethren. We're related to them. We have a relationship. All we need is a project to pull them together. So organization is the second component to this power. It's amazing how in the Jerusalem Convention, you know, all we had to say was there's going to be a convention in Jerusalem in 1993, and all of a sudden, whammo! I was amazed at the amount of response coming in from all over the world. Third component of the power is money. We will need lots of it. Now, for the Lord, that's easy. It's tough for us, but easy for the Lord. You know, I was speculating. You know how sometimes you do, you have a pencil and paper and you speculate? I says, if we had 30 capitals in the world, Tokyo, Bombay, or New Delhi, Rome, London, New York, Los Angeles, and so forth. If you had 30 capitals and you advertise in the paper, let's say twice a month for a whole year, it would come up to something like $6 million. Now, that's challenging for us individually. But that's not a bad challenge. Take a look at the retirement center. Would you believe it? Just a small group of brethren put together that retirement center. $1.5 million, which is the book value of the retirement center, came together. If you'd have said to me, it took $1.5 million to put that together when we first got started, we'd say, we'll never make it. And there's $1.5 million. That's $4 million market value. I believe that when the Lord is ready with this project, with this special dispensation, when this special dividing is to occur, the money will come, and it'll come in easy, and the brethren will cooperate. Let's take a fifth component of the power. It is end-time motivation. Fourth component. It is end-time motivation. There won't be any debate whether God is wrapping up in the high calling and the translation is near. The Elijahs will rise up, all of them, with a strength never before realized. It will be a power never seen among the brethren. And they will be convinced that the door to the high calling is about to end. There's a fifth component of power of the mantle, and it would be a miracle. It would be miraculous. You know, when Elijah took the mantle off, he wrapped it up. And if you take a mantle and you wrap it up, it's like a rod. That suggests something to you? Moses, with his rod, if you remember, struck the Red Sea and the waters divided. So we believe that this special blessing effort that the Lord will use will be in many ways miraculous. Now the question, did Brother Russell did smiting of the Jordan work? In my view, yes. He smote the Jordan. Do you know of anyone in the world who would dare call the papacy the Antichrist in writing? Do you know of anybody in the world who will call the governments the beast of Revelation? Do you know of anyone who would dare call Christendom the harlot that robes the beast? I don't know of anyone. It took a courage and strength found in no one except John the Baptist. Yes, Brother Russell smoked the Jordan, but it was not effective. It didn't do the job. It didn't divide the people. It divided the world politically. The empires were smashed, 1914. In fact, from 1949 on, England owned half the world. Today, the British Empire is divided into at least 16 separate republics. And the division continues. From 1914 to now, Russia was a vast empire. Today, 14 republics want their freedom. From the Ukraine to Lithuania, from Azerbaijan to Latvia. From 1914 now, Yugoslavia was one country. Today, the Serbs, the Croatians, the Slavs want their own freedom. The long-lost Kurds in Turkey, Iraq, and Russia, they want their own country, Kurdistan. Interesting to note about Iraq. Iraq wanted Kuwait. Wanted to swallow them up. Interesting that the countries that went against Iraq were countries that swallowed other countries. If there is a great contradiction. The world continues to divide politically, but the religious division has not happened. In fact, religion has grown enormously. Christianity is now the number one religion in the world. Look at the statistics. The World Almanac has it. The Religious Encyclopedia has it. It is the number one religion in the world. It wasn't in that position some time ago. The Jordan still continues its descending route with its pollution. Brother Russell didn't do the job because of three reasons, and I'll give them to you. First, the glorified Christ with Jesus and the resurrected saints were not ready to inaugurate the kingdom in 1914 because there was yet room. The 144,000 was not complete. Just think about it, friends. If it was complete in 1914, you and I wouldn't be here. Is that sobering? If it was complete then, there's few of us that were born before 1914. But the Lord says there is yet room. And so we've been called in. The high calling continues. That's one reason. The second reason, that those who were here had not completed their development. The crystallization of character was not complete. There's a third reason. The smiting was ineffective because Israel was not a nation in 1914. Again, remember Malachi 4, 5 to 6. Elijah will turn the world to Israel and Israel to the world. And we see now in unmistakable terms, the world is mesmerized in their look at Israel. These are the three reasons why it did not occur. Church not complete. Defeat members' development was not completed. Israel was not a nation. This explains why we're 77 years beyond the 1914 date. And you can smite the Jordan all you want. That's not the key. The key is when you smite the Jordan, there is no more room in the high calling. Defeat members have crystallized their character, and Israel is alone. There have been many people who claim to smite. Many people have claimed that they've smitten the Jordan, but their smiting has been as ineffective as a mosquito biting an elephant. Some have raised the question whether or not we should expect an eighth messenger. Or was Brother Russell the sixth messenger and the seventh to come? I would say no to both those ideas. Again, what is the work? We know it's separating organized religion from their membership, and we know it's connected with Israel. The issue will be Israel, but we don't know exactly what it is. Let's take a fifth issue of the journey. Elijah wrap up with the translation scene is a stupendous scene. Fiery horses, fiery chariot, and a devastating whirlwind. Does that mean trouble for the church members? I think so in some ways before they get into the chariot. But once they get in the chariot, then more trouble comes. So they have some experience. But not as bad as Elisha. Elisha will have a lot of experience. There'll be violent trouble, severe persecution. I believe and suggest to you that the whirlwind is caused by the release of the four winds of Revelation 7, 1 to 4, which you studied yesterday. I hope this conforms or is compatible with that. Involving spiritual forces, and these winds are released after the sealing of the forehead. This means that the door to the high calling is closed. The church is complete. And the successors have been chosen, which is Elisha. Let's take the sixth and last issue of the journey. Elisha picks up the mantle, goes over to the Jordan, and rolls it again, and smashes the Jordan. And we see there's a connection there between the five foolish virgins and Elisha. Remember, the five foolish virgins didn't have the oil when the bridegroom came. But they went out to buy, and they did buy, and they did come back with the oil. You got to remember that, friends. They did come back. But it was too late. The door was closed. So they had that spirit. They had that zeal. And so Elisha is the successor and takes up the work of Elijah and proceeds with the second smiting. Apparently the waters of Jordan have seeped back again and continues to divide. That's the reason why we said they are partially successful. And that's the reason why the Lord says we've got to bring in. Just like he did with Noah. He says the flood is the only answer to them. And he will say that to the world. Armageddon is the only answer to the world. And we would suggest to you that Elisha takes up that work in a very miraculous way, proceeds to finish up the inauguration of the kingdom. And when Elisha emerges on the other side of the Jordan, we would suggest to you that the type changes. Elijah is killed, just like Elijah is destroyed in the trouble. And the type changes, and Elisha then, if you follow 2 Kings, then becomes the ancient worthy class. Okay, let me conclude with some lessons. First lesson, friends. Are you an Elijah or an Elisha? You must make up your mind which class you're in. The time for choosing a place is rapidly passing. No one will put you in those classes but yourself. Are you a looker or are you a smiter? Second lesson. The Elijah work is a work of end time. And those of you who regard yourself as antitypical Elijahs, if you think you are, be on your guard, for end time is near. And the opportunity to smite the Jordan is near. When it comes, seize it. Smite the Jordan with all your strength and might, for this is God's will. Third lesson. The vengeance of antitypical Jezebel on antitypical Elijah will be violent. We must all die to win our heavenly prize. Fourth lesson, as the Lord's people, we have been forewarned of the impending events that will come to pass. Never can one say, the Lord, where are we going? The Lord is saying, I'm telling you what's going to happen. We know. Fifth lesson, let both the elect class and the great company class walk together. Let us not separate. Let us walk through Gilgal and Bethel and Jericho and Jordan until God will separate us with the vehicle to go home. Remember, those of you who are of the Elijah class, it's the Elisha class that will carry on your work. So isn't it important that you develop a special relationship with them so that you carry on the work well? Sixth lesson. Avoid any actions that exhibit a condescending attitude. I'm church class, you're elect class, or you're great company class. Avoid any actions. Nobody will say it publicly, but you'll say it with your attitudes. And you'll say it with a condescending, I have the truth and you don't. Watch out for that. The final lesson. Watch out for the trap that the Lord is using me. Therefore, I'm church class. The Lord is not using you. You're great company class. Watch out for that trap. God used Moses, and he never saw the promised land. God used Aaron as the high priest, the great mentor. Aaron was defrocked. God used Judas, and he wasn't one of the 12. God used Napoleon, but Napoleon is not in the church class. God used Gorbachev, and Gorbachev is not in the... God may use George Bush, and he's not in the church class. God will use many and all agencies to bring about his plan. That does not mean that they are in the elect class. And what a privilege it is for us to be a part of the Elijah class. And when the time comes, smite the Jordan with all your strength and might, for it will be the way for inaugurating the kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Paul. Everyone take a lot of notes. If you have questions, there's the gentleman to see.